The following program brought to you by Comprehensive Financial Consultants and CFCI, which is solely responsible for its content. Securities are offered through J.W. Cole Financial, member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI and J.W. Cole Advisors. J.W. Cole Financial, J.W. Cole Advisors, and CFCI are unaffiliated entities. The opinions expressed by the members of CFCI and their guests should not be construed as specific investment, legal, or tax advice. All economic and performance information is historical and not indicative of future results. Investing may involve the risk of loss of principal, and any tax advice on the show is not intended to be used by any persons for the purpose of avoiding U.S. federal or state tax. Penalties that may be imposed on such persons and each listener should seek advice from their tax advisor or legal counsel on topics that arise from the show. The representatives of CFCI and their guests are not providing legal or tax advice, and nothing should be construed as a solicitation to offer or buy securities. Now enjoy the show. Hey everyone, welcome to the big show, Your Money with David Hayes. Glad you're hanging out with me. I have a pretty darn good show lined up today. You know, everyone likes predicting and projecting and forecasting, and we're going to get into a little bit of the back testing of some of these great predictions from these great minds in the financial industry and why they have consistently been wrong and why you shouldn't listen to them. So Eric Giesler is going to join me at about the bottom of the hour, and we're going to be talking about that. We also have a couple things later in the program on muting intellectual noise, and that'll be a continued discussion on what all these people have said over the years and why you just need to mute out all this intellectual noise, because at the end of the day, what they say really does not matter. And then later on, if we have time, the winding road to retirement. There's been a lot of research on what retirement plan participants do as far as spending, savings, and what their debt profiles are. Get a better understanding of what the impact that has on retirement savings. And we're going to go through some pretty interesting things, I think, that will, if you're an employer, sort of motivate you to maybe do some things for your employees to get them more financial stress-free. Because if they are more stress-free as an employee, they typically make a much better employee. Let's do a little news of the week. Brought to you by our friends over at the Monroe County Sports Hall of Fame, supported by us here at Comprehensive Financial Consultants. To learn more about Monroe County Sports Hall of Fame, go to mcshof.com or just Google our good old buddies over at the Monroe County Sports Hall of Fame. You know, immigration is in the news, right? Have you heard about that? DACA and all that? And you know what you need to understand is that our doors still swing in here, and they always have. In a lot of countries, they don't. I mean, Japan, as an example, has virtually no immigration, but we still have positive immigration here. We're just trying to get, you know, all the details straightened out as far as how people actually come and stay. But I found this pretty interesting. Came from by the numbers. 43% of the Fortune 500 companies in 2017 were co-founded or founded by either an immigrant to the United States or by a child of an immigrant. So at the end of the day, most of us are all children of or descendants of immigrants. All right, the nation's GDP growth for 2017 will be reported on 1/26 of 18, so just in a week or two. And it's going to show an increase of about 3% or more for the last year. It will end a record streak of 11 consecutive years of sub 3% growth. The next longest streak in the history of sub 3% growth is a four-year span all the way back 1930 through 1933. And, you know, you've heard us talk on the show a lot about demographics, predictable spending patterns, and the fact that 70% of our GDP growth comes from consumer spending. And as the baby boomers started to creep into their older years, their late 50s, early 60s, you know, now even up to age 70, that their spending would slow. And it's not that they don't still have money or they're not making good money. It's just now that their kids are out of the house, they're doing different things with their money. They're saving, they're investing, they're paying down debts, and that's not real expensive to the economy. So for the last 16 years here on the show, we talked about the coming slowdown of economic growth due to lack of consumer spending. And now, as the children of the boomers, the millennials, the Gen Xers, which I'm part of, are creating families, they have jobs, they're spending money, we're going to start seeing that spending wave pick back up. So if you go back and listen to, and I don't even know if you can archive this, but go back and listen to a show, let's say, I don't know, 2008, I don't have any idea, and we talked a lot about when we thought spending would start to pick back up again, when economic growth would pick back up. And that's part of it. I mean, but obviously we look at tax reform, we look at the deregulations, we look at a lot of other things that could contribute to positive GDP growth. So we'll see. But one thing that we talked a lot about over the years is the peak in college enrollments. Now, I know here in Bloomington, because we have Indiana University and a big well-known school, a Big Ten school, a great school of this and a great school of that, that we're able to attract very very good numbers of students. And the way that we would keep our numbers high is that you either lowered the standards of, like when I went to school there, the standards were very, very low, fortunately. But now the average GPA is like 3.8 or something when you come into the when you come into IU. But when you look nationally, there were actually 18.8 million college students during the fall of 2017. That's actually the sixth consecutive year that they were fewer than the year before. That's the total number of students that have declined year over year. So it's actually been happening that we've had fewer college students entering college nationally, but just not here at Indiana University. And again, that's because of the peak of the baby boom generation, born 1961. First child born on average at age 27, the second one at 29. Do the math on that. It tells you exactly when you should have had peak enrollments in universities kind of peak out and then start to head the other way. But the other thing could be a movement that I'm starting to see of kids that are shunning the traditional four-year college and looking at technical schools and other ways that they can get out and make money pretty quickly and not have to go through the entire liberal arts degree process or whatever else you might go through. But they are needing a skill, that's for sure. But I'm seeing a movement there. I'm seeing that from witnessing several senior nights with the wrestling around the conferences as I've traveled around to watch my son, a lot of senior nights, and not everyone's headed off to here or headed off to there. Some people are, going into the trades, which is fantastic. I heard one last night when we were over at the Edgewood South, the wrestling meet. A kid was coming through senior night, mom and dad, and when they announced what he was going to do after high school, he's going to enter the trades. I thought that's great. Because student loan debt, this comes from By the Numbers as well, has increased by nearly $1 trillion so over the last 12 years. Outstanding student loan debt was $380 billion as of 9/30/05, climbing by over $980 billion to $1.3 trillion as of September of 2017. So obviously, people are starting to get it that maybe sometimes it's not worth spending all that money to still do what it is that you could have done without spending all that money. And then finally, Apple is set to pay big tax bill, touts U.S. spending as well. This came out of the Wall Street Journal. Apple Incorporated said it would pay a one-time tax of $38 billion on its overseas cash holdings, ramp up its spending in the U.S. as it seeks to emphasize its contribution to the American economy after years of taking criticism for outsourcing manufacturing to, of course, China. The world's most valuable company laid out plans on Wednesday in a statement that was full of big dollar investment figures, but didn't really specify exactly how much would be in their plan. But they did say this: they would invest $30 billion in capital spending in the U.S. over the next 5 years. That would create, they said, more than 20,000 jobs. That includes a new campus, which initially will house technical support for consumers, $10 billion towards data centers across the country, and the expansion from $1 billion to $5 billion to fund its established fund last year to invest in advanced U.S. manufacturing. All told, Apple said it would directly contribute $350 billion to the U.S. economy over the next 5 years, with the bulk of that, $55 billion, this year. So, and that, for example, coming from like ongoing spending on parts and services from U.S. suppliers. That number also included the federal tax payment and capital spending they plan to do in 2018. So a lot of good things happening with this tax reform. So we'll hope and pray that it continues on. Let's take a break. When we come back, it was my birthday this week, as a good friend of mine used to say. I turned 48. Give you a little perspective on what I did for my birthday and what I'm kind of thinking about as I've gained another year closer to the end, as I put it with a friend this week. I'll be right back to talk about that and more. This is Your Money with David Hayes. So I turned 48 years old this week, January 16, 1970. You know, it used to be back, 10, 15 years ago, people would say, "How old are you?" And I would tell them, whatever, I was 30, 35, and I've been in the business since 1994. So I'm 48, been in the business since 1994, or basically 24 years. So I've been doing what I've been doing for half of my life. Now, that's pretty cool, right? But there were a time where I was a little bit like, I'm maybe too young to for you to trust me with these finances or with doing this or that. I think I've got that whipped by now. 48 and 24, that adds up to a lot of age and a lot of experience. So I've been through some things. But I'm also more than half done. My life is. There's no question about it. I mean, if I was, again, 48 plus, that would put me, what, at 96? You know, I'm probably closer to three-fourths done. That would put me at about, what, 72? So hoping I'm somewhere between three-fourths done and half done. And that's only if I did the math quickly. I am just a financial advisor. But, you know, helping people prepare for and succeed for retirement over the last 24 years has been a real great privilege of mine. So I want to say thank you. And on Wednesday morning, I called in to talk with Glass, and he pointed out to me that I was, and I have been doing this for my half of my life. So that does put things into perspective. And I, you know, I've been thinking a lot about time and wasting time and different things like that. But, you know, when you think about time, it's something that you can never get back. You know, every time you choose to do something, you're trading that time for whatever that activity it is that you chose. Now, there are a lot of things you can get back. I mean, if you lose money, you can go earn some more money back. If you get sick, you know, you get sick, you can get well. But if you lose a day, it's gone forever. So I think the reason that time goes faster the older you get, it's all about perspective. I mean, we start talking about planning for spring break coming up soon, and it seems like it's just around the corner for me. But to my 17-year-old son, it seems like forever away. Now, he still has a bedtime, and his friends were making fun of him because he said, I'm almost 18. And I'm like, you just turned 17 in December. You're not almost 18. Now, but he might be more right than I am. I mean, he is almost 18. As fast as time goes, time flies. Any way you put it, I mean, I don't like it. I don't like the fact that time is going by so quickly. I don't like the fact that my parents are getting older. I don't like the fact that I'm losing grip of my son as he enters adulthood. I don't enjoy that I'm getting older. I mean, at 48, a lot of you are thinking, 48, gosh, I wish I was still 48. And some of you are thinking, oh my gosh, I cannot wait until, or maybe you're thinking, gosh, I don't know what I'm going to be doing when I get to 48. But I know the demographic of my listening audience, and you're probably thinking, gosh, it was great when I was 48. And it was great when I was 48. Someone sent me a text that said, it is great that I'm 48, but someone sent me a text that said, happy 25th birthday. And I wrote back, that is definitely an age I would not want to go back to. 25, I mean, think about it when you were 25, the struggles and trying to find your identity and trying to get things going. And then even 30, you had that sort of question in your mind, is this what I'm supposed to be doing when I was 30? And then you do it again at 40. You know, but everything's going just fine. But I do think that at the end of the day, you just have to really think about what you're doing with your time. And is your time being used in a valuable way? Are you wasting time? And just know that you can't ever get it back. So, you know, as I think about these things that I want to hang on to, I mean, any way you put it, I don't like it, like I said, but hang on to those times, you know, and hope that there's more good times that are coming along. And that's what you have to look forward to. And it's interesting when you talk to people, like I am in my 40s. I love my 40s. I enjoyed my 30s great deal. I enjoyed my 20s. I just wouldn't want to go back there. But when I talk to folks that are my friends that are in their 50s or clients that are in their 60s and 70s, there comes a point where they're like, yeah, I don't really like this anymore. But for the most part, where you are at the stage of life that you are, you tend to be fairly happy for the most part. So, you know, be right with your family, be right with your friends, be right with your coworkers, your community, your Lord, and you just got to hope for the best. So a friend of mine sent me one of these birthday posts, kind of like a newspaper from when you were born. So this came from, you know, January 16, 1970, and just some of the cool things that it pointed out, like cost of living comparisons. In 1970, you could buy a gallon of milk for $1.32. Now it's about $3.50. A loaf of bread was 24 cents. Now it's $1.32. A new car, $2,500. I mean, my father-in-law purchased his 1970 Chevy truck, which I have now. We have in our family. I had it somewhat restored, not completely, but you know, to where I at least drive it down the road and people think it's kind of cool. And that's about what he paid for that 1970 pickup. We'll go try to buy a pickup over at Curry today. I mean, goodness gracious, or any of the other great dealerships around. It ain't $2,500. In fact, they're saying the average new car cost $28,950. Well, I drove through the car lot the other day, just kind of nosing around. I didn't see very many cars at $28,950. Most of them were much higher than that. And then a gallon of gas, 1970, was 40 cents. I remember when I started driving in 1986, gas was 50, 60, 70, 80 cents a gallon. Never. I don't remember paying a dollar. I mean, if you had an ashtray full of coins, you were good to go. It was pretty much in my Ford Pinto as far as you'd want to go. In 2018, I mean, you know where it's about $3 a gallon, and who knows where it will be next week. New houses, $40,000 on average in 1970, about $250,000 a day. And, of course, in the investment world, the Dow Jones Industrial Average in January 16, 1970, was 838. And, of course, now it's, what, over 25, going to 26,000. So a lot has changed since 1970. And, you know, even things like award-winning movies. There were, who won Best Actor? George C. Scott for his role in Patton. That's kind of cool. Famous people born on this date? Not very many of them, so I'm not going to mention them. The highlights in sports, Baltimore Orioles win the World Series. New York Knicks beat the L.A. Lakers in basketball to become the NBA champions. Minnesota Vikings. Now, here's the interesting thing. In the Super Bowl that year, oh, by the way, Al Unser won the Indy 500. Good old Al. The Super Bowl, the Kansas City Chiefs beat the Minnesota Vikings 23-7. Of course, the Vikings are still in the hunt. And when I was a kid, the Vikings went to four back-to-back Super Bowls, never won, and that actually is the reason I became a Vikings fan before later on in life, you know, the Colts and different things like that we had to root for. So kind of some cool things that happened back in 1970. Here was another one I saw on the 16th. Colonel Gaddafi becomes the president of Libya in his State of the Union message. President Nixon calls for a new American experience. The nation's first priority remains, the president says, to bring an end to the war in Vietnam. Only then can we begin to make repairs to the damage out of air, land, and water. So interesting stuff. Kind of neat to go back in history and check things out. All right, guys, when we come back, I'm going to be joined by Mr. Eric Giesler, our fixed income specialist at CFCI. We're going to get into this concept of predicting, forecasting, projecting, whatever it might be, putting your opinion forth, and what does it really mean when it comes to you making decisions from a financial perspective. We'll be right back in a few minutes. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. Still waiting for Mr. Giesler to join us. He actually had a physical therapy appointment, so maybe it went a little bit long. He told me he'd be calling in right after that. No problem. No sweat, Big E. We'll take care of it from here as I kind of look at my notes here, making sure that I'm lined up correctly. Oh, yeah, here we go. So, you know, obviously, folks, the markets are off to a fantastic start this year. You know, we didn't receive a tremendous amount of economic data last week, but the economy did provide a few details that started to reveal how it's continuing to pick up speed. I mean, both in the corporate earnings world and inflation appear to be on the rise. As earnings season is upon us, the analysts expect the data will indicate strong corporate earning performance in the fourth quarter of 2017. Some projections show corporate earnings may have risen by as much as 11% between October and December of last year. That would be fantastic. Each of the S&P 500 sectors, there's 11 of them, will likely record in both revenue and earnings records. We haven't seen that kind of stuff since 2011. So the earnings seasons will also provide some perspectives on how large corporations expect tax reform to affect them. As we make plans for 2018, this information will help us inform, obviously, our strategies and our message to you. And we're already seeing that. We saw Apple, you know, announce what they're going to be doing with a lot of extra money that they'll be pouring into the U.S. economy. So on last Friday, the CPI data came out showing an unexpected uptick in core inflation. And at first glance, the inflation numbers don't seem particularly noteworthy. The CPI's December growth was only 0.1%. And its annual growth rate was 2.1, which met expectations. But when digging a little bit deeper, you'll see that the CPI rose at 2.6% annualized during the fourth quarter alone. That's faster than the Fed's 2% inflation target. So what was interesting, and by the way, that doesn't include food and energy because, of course, no one eats food or uses any energy. So that's why they pull it out, I guess. But at first, the markets kind of sold off because they thought, uh-oh, if the inflation's getting a little bit out of control, which is not out of control, but the markets kind of overreact, that maybe the Fed will increase its aggressiveness when increasing rates. So again, faster inflation combined with our current strong labor market and low unemployment, that might mean that interest rates will also pick up later this year. So with CPI data that we've seen, the Fed will likely increase rates at least three times in 2018 and maybe even four. So of course, higher inflation might also impact stock performance. So again, when the CPI numbers came out on that Friday, first stocks stumbled as people worried about economic growth, how it could slow if Fed raised interest rates too quickly. But then the strong earnings reports came out, and that demonstrated our economy's pretty strong and underpinned and assured, I guess, the people that do all that trading and in the market kind of rebounded. So we've experienced, you know, we haven't experienced such strong inflation increases in a long time. And as more details around inflation and economic growth come out, we will continue to, of course, monitor that and how it might affect you and your investments and your financial life. And obviously, if you ever have any questions, we're always open for email questions, and I love to answer them. I don't get to them right away, but I promise you, if you email me, I will email you back. And if you email through cfci.us, that's cfci.us, then it will come to someone in our office, and then eventually it will make it to me, and then I will turn around and give you a fantastic answer. At least that's, in my opinion, what it will be. But, you know, the people take this data that I just shared with you, and they make predictions. I'm not a predictor. I hate predictions because most of the time you're wrong. If you think about a weather forecaster, they're forecasting what might happen. But if they get into predicting where they say this is what will happen, that's usually when they're wrong. So there's a big difference between predicting and forecasting, or projecting and predicting. I can project what I think things will be, but I'm not going to predict this will be the outcome. Or reporting something versus your opinion of something. I mean, it may look like a fine line, and I think it is in many cases, but you just have to be careful. So as I've always said about things, you should control the things you can control and then kind of ignore everything else. And that kind of leads us into our next segment, muting the intellectual noise. And Eric will hopefully be joining us here in a few minutes. But how do you, you know, go from, you know, hearing all this stuff to just blocking it out? I mean, at the end of the day, when I think about people getting caught up in predictions, I mean, it's human nature. I mean, what, you know, why do you go to a fortune teller or a palm reader? I mean, we want to know what's coming. I mean, unless something is right in your face, I wouldn't say it's going to for sure happen. And I would say it might still not happen. I mean, I've been in business a long time, and I've kind of taken this position that if something can happen in this world, it might very well happen. I mean, look at the end of the Vikings and Saints game the last week. Who would have ever thought that the Saints guy would have come in with his head down and shoulder and arms not wide enough to make a stinking tackle? I mean, who would have predicted that? But it could have happened. I mean, that could have happened, that he's going to miss a tackle and the Vikings score, and now they're going into the NFC Championship. So things like that can happen. So as I've been forecasting, and actually I've been on the borderline of predicting, that like tax rates are going to go up in the future. I don't know for sure that tax rates are going to go up in the future, but I can forecast out based on some pretty solid numbers and listening to some pretty smart people that the chances are better that taxes will be higher in the future than they are today. Now, what if I'm wrong? Well, who really cares? If I'm wrong, that just means you have more money sitting in tax-free accounts. So I run the risk occasionally of predicting over forecasting, or, you know, putting my opinion as fact. I understand that. I think we all do that. Or projecting instead of predicting is a good thing. So there's just this idea that we have a starving innate thing going on in our body that says we want to know what's going on. And I love this thing that Warren Buffett says, or a quote from Warren Buffett, that what the human being is best at doing is interpreting all the new information so that their prior conclusions remain intact. That's Warren Buffett. And it's really a pretty embarrassing track record for Wall Street forecasters / predictors, folks who are paid to predict what the markets will do every year. They have a terrible track record. I mean, they never predict a down year, which is very, very interesting. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, hopefully we'll be joined by Eric Giesler, and his neck has been stretched and his back has been rubbed or whatever he's doing at physical therapy. And he'll join us live to talk about muting the intellectual noise in our world. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. Your Money with David Hayes. Thanks so much for hanging out with me. We've had a fun show so far. And as promised, Mr. Eric Giesler is now on the phone with us. How was physical therapy, Biggie? I just told everyone on the air how you...
It's always tough for me. When you're old and fat like I am, it's always tough.
But it's no, always it was a good time. Before you came on, I was talking about just predictions and why people love to get caught up in predictions. It's just human nature. I mean, why do you go to a fortune teller? Why do you go to a palm reader? I can tell you I've never been to either one of those, but I know a lot of people go. But I think we have this this something inside us that we want to know what's coming. And if we have a compelling story of why this outcome will happen and it's a prediction, then we tend to make silly decisions and follow those. And I liked what Warren Buffett said. What the human being is best at doing is interpreting all the new information that comes out so that their prior conclusions remain intact. Eric, you've been doing this a long time. That seems to be the mantra of the folks on Wall Street when they try to explain why something didn't happen that they predicted would happen, right?
Well, I think what makes it even more difficult is there is rarely any evidence of their prediction. And when I say that, there isn't any research or consequence to their prediction. They can be wrong, they can be right, but there's very little empirical data that allows you to support your original conclusion. And unfortunately, on a daily basis, we hear this noise or we hear news, and it kind of distorts what the real information and why prices are moving or capital allocations are changing. It kind of distorts that because we have these biases already built in.
And really, if you look back, it's an embarrassing track record for Wall Street forecasters. I mean, the folks that are paid to predict what the markets will do every year have a terrible track record. I mean, comparing averages of the forecasts made by Wall Street experts to the actual performance of, let's say, the S&P 500 reveals a long history of just flat-out blown predictions. And as I looked at a chart from, I think it was 2000 all the way through 2014, maybe even longer, the forecasted gains versus the actual gains, some years were a little bit close, but I thought it was very, very interesting to see that I didn't see one time in all of the years where the forecasters predicted a negative year. No, none of them have ever came out and said, this year, I think it's going down 20%. I mean, all of them were always positive across the board, and you can look at this chart that I'm looking at. I think I sent it to you, and it's all over the board. People just get this wrong all the time.
Well, and it's different from country to country, and now that we're in this global economy, what is positive in one country isn't necessarily positive in a negative, and therefore it's difficult to correlate what's going on over there and how that might impact what's going on here. And more often than not, it's actually a negative and does have a significant relationship between the two, but we don't consider what's going on over there and how it might impact here. It's the old Wall Street Journal every year, you know, throwing the darts at the
right.
Monkeys throw the darts and,
yeah.
And they outperform the top 10.
Well, or the top, you know, the top 10 performing funds in 2017, they're always like the bottom 50% the next year. There's some pretty famous names like Whitney Tilson, and back in 2004, a well-known person in our industry, he says, I believe that it is virtually a certain thing that Google's stock will be highly disappointing to investors foolish enough to participate in its overhyped offering. And you can hold me to that. That was a pretty bold prediction that didn't come true. And then I love Fannie Mae. The subprime assets, Big E, are so riskless that their capital for holding them should be under 2%. I mean, golly.
Well, in anticipation of this opportunity to be on the radio with you, I went back and I looked at the last 10 years, and there isn't one year that I can find an institutional representative that ever got the level of the 30-year or the 10-year correct. So,
well, and that's why
even the experts of experts, their opinions are less precise than yours and mine.
Well, so. And that's why we obviously have to forecast, but there's a big difference between forecasting and predicting, because I think forecasting, you could say, well, you know, if this happens, I can see this happening. But if this happens, I can see that happening. And that's why I think when you're in the money management business, you have to be aware of both sides of the argument and somewhere in the middle. And that's typically where the truth lies. I love 2007 when AIG said, it's hard for us without being flippant to even see a scenario of any kind, of any reason, that would see us losing $1 on these credit default swap transactions. Of course, that's what nearly brought the entire financial market down. I love when Steve Ballmer, who of course is a Microsoft founder, he said, there's no chance the iPhone is going to get any significant market share. That was back in 2007. And of course, Jim Cramer, everyone loves the, you know, buy, 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 sell, sell, sell. And I enjoy Jim. He's fun to watch. But, you know, I remember back in 2008, he was also telling people after the market had crashed that if you want your money in the next 5 years, don't be in stocks, right? And we only saw the biggest rally ever in the history of the stock market from the bottom of March of 2009 through the next 5 years. But he says in 2008, no, 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 Bear Stearns is just fine. Don't move your money from Bear Stearns. It's just being silly. So, once again, Big E, I mean, do not watch the TV. Do not make investment decisions based on what you're hearing these, quote, really smart people. And I'm not saying they're not smart people. They're smart people. And they could have forecasted that if this happens, this could happen. If this could happen, if that might happen. But just get out of the way of these crazy, crazy predictions.
Well, I think it goes back to what you touched on earlier, and that's about risk. Yes, there's going to be good times and there's going to be bad times. And from a financial perspective, are you prepared for both? That you're, you know, it's kind of the highs and lows of life. You don't get too excited and don't get too high and don't get too low either. So it's all about allocation.
Meredith Whitney.
And how can you manage the risk?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Meredith Whitney back in 2010 kind of rocked the municipal bond market when she said I could see 50 to 100 sizable defaults in 2010. And you know, I remember listening to that thinking there's no way, but I could see some defaults, and we've seen some defaults. So she wasn't off, just she was too far off. Alan Greenspan, I mean, if you go back and look at Alan Greenspan quotes, he was wrong so many times it was ridiculous. You have The Economist, without a dramatic change of heart by the European Central Bank, and European leaders, the single currency could break up within weeks. And, you know, that came from The Economist back in 2011. Didn't happen in weeks. I'm not saying that still may not happen. So he could forecast it could happen at some time in the future, and there's some scenario that could cause it to break up in the next few weeks. I'm not saying that could happen or will happen. That's a better way to put these type of scenarios rather than say it could happen in the next within the next few weeks. So it kind of gets people, you know, scared.
It's hard to apply that noise or that information and its real effect on the prices of capital. And that's what happens, is that we think we're at a high price or we're at a low price based upon what I call this noise or this. It's just information that kind of distorts what's going on in the market.
Well, Harry Dent is a fantastic example. And I've had Harry on the show. I love Harry. I think he's a really smart guy, and he can forecast some of the most predictable spending patterns of consumers in industrialized countries there are, and he can relate that to when things such as peak enrollments in universities are likely to happen, or when starter homes are going to be the hot thing, or this, that, or the other. And he's been right within a small margin of error, but he's then tried to relate that to, okay, when this happens, this is going to cause this to happen in the stock market. And when he would say it, you would believe it because of how compelling the story was, but Harry's been wrong pretty much 99% of the time, and I'm being generous there on where the market's going to go.
Well, the clock's right twice a day. Right?
Well, in this case, maybe, I mean, in some people's it's never right, but I mean, yeah, broken clock is right twice a day. There were some other pretty interesting quotes that we found from Jamie Dimon. Of course, he's been famous of recent times of saying Bitcoin's this and Bitcoin's that, and then Bitcoin would go up. And I'm not, you know, Bitcoin's kind of lost its luster, hasn't it? People aren't talking about it like it was when it was at 17,000. When it gets to 10, people are kind of ignoring it again. But Jamie Dimon, of course, with J.P. Morgan, he says, I think you all should be ready. This is from 2013. You should all be ready because rates are going up. Well, they haven't really gone up. 2013, in fact, they went up maybe a little, but they went down again and then kind of stabilized. I think you pointed out to me in a meeting we recently had with one of our large clients that For instance, the 10-year Treasury and the 30-year Treasury have barely moved year over year.
Right.
Yeah, so do rates have to go up? No, they don't have to go up. They could stay. Ask Japan. I mean, Japan's been fighting this thing for 20-plus years. And, you know, obviously we have a few things going on for us that Japan hadn't going on for them, such as popular news immigration. We have positive immigration. We had, you know, we had some good GDP growth. We've actually seen a little bit of inflation, and those are things that could and probably should cause interest rates to go up, but that doesn't mean they have to go up. So again, we on this radio show for the past, well, since the financial crisis, Big E, when people were saying, well, rates have got to go up sometime, right? Well, yeah, sometime, but probably, you know, maybe not this year, maybe not in the next 5, maybe not in the next 10 years. And I'm proud to say we were right in forecasting that that could happen, that rates could stay low for a long time, and that's exactly what's happened.
Right. And the allocation away from interest rates into price behavior has proved beneficial to our clients.
So, Big E, I want you to know, and I know it's going to make you feel good, it's okay to be different.
since
1994 when CFCI started, and then 2002. Was it 2002 when we joined forces? I'm trying to remember.
2003.
I would say we have forged our own path, you know, by focusing
yes,
on what we think is best for our clients and not worrying about what the current Fed is. So I appreciate you and the experience you had and you brought to me. And what was interesting, E, is that, you know, I turned 48 years old this week, and you were at my age or younger whenever we got together. So it's amazing how fast time goes.
Yes, it is.
It's been a good ride,
though.
Let's keep it going, man.
We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a quick break, guys. When we come back, okay, what is the human being best at doing? It's interpreting all the information so that their prior conclusions can remain intact. I might have to put that one to memory. When we come back, we're going to hopefully have time to talk about the winding road to retirement, why it's so important that employers start to educate their employees on things like spending, savings, and debt management to give them an opportunity to save more for retirement. We'll be back. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Thank you, Big E. Appreciate you being on the show, adding what you add each and every time you're on. Good, stable, you know, person to have around. We give everyone a hard time. The equity people like Hot Rod are typically glass half full. The debt, the bond guys are generally glass half empty. I'm just kind of somewhere in between. People that know me know that my cup runneth over with enthusiasm and optimism. So I have these guys around to kind of keep me in check. Well, let me tell you this. Financial stress, it's impacting employee productivity. And when they need help, participants are typically looking to trusted institutions, including their employer, their record keeper, their financial professionals that are on the plan. Also, looking deeper into participants' spending, saving, and debt profiles, we better understand the impact that has on their retirement savings. It's clear that people need to manage their competing financial objectives so that they can save for retirement. It's obvious to me, and as we've gotten deeper into some financial education with some of the local employers, it's becoming more and more evident to me, because life is stressful and finances are a significant cause of that stress. In 2007, 71% of participants in a plan have experienced moderate to extreme stress in the last 6 months. This all comes from a John Hancock survey, which is titled The Winding Road to Retirement. 66% say that finances are a significant cause of stress, and 64% rate their financial situation only good to excellence. But that's okay, 64% not bad. Bottom line is, even when people are feeling good about their financial situation, finances continue to cause stress. When you look at how financial stress can impact the employer, people that are under financial stress spend time on their finances at work, and they know it's impacting their productivity. I mean, 38% of workers say that they worry about their finances and they actually focus on it when they're at work. I mean, 44% of people say they spend an hour or more on their personal finances at work. And 42% say, yep, we definitely feel less productive at work because of the worries that we have about our personal finances. So this equals an additional cost to the employer as well. So when people want to or reach out for help, who do they reach out to? Well, first they jump online, they do some personal research, they go maybe to their employer or maybe their retirement plan provider, and then lastly to a financial professional. So when they make these important financial decisions, they definitely are turning to these trusted institutions for help. So you need to be there ready to help them. And I think that that is starting to happen. People are starting to recognize at the corporate level that, hey, we can't just expect them to show up because we're paying them a decent wage. I mean, people don't know how to handle money. I mean, when you think about how hard it is to save, especially when you have these competing objectives for your dollar, I mean, what about putting a plan together to put an emergency fund aside, or money to eliminate a credit card debt, or simply money to do this or do that? I mean, it's hard. And then you have friends and family that are pulling on you. It's just very, very difficult. So when you think about the competing objectives for that $1, that's why we encourage people to do things like, you know, the Dave Ramsey money, total money makeover. It's, you can go to Ivy Tech Community College. They're putting on a free course. It's coming up. Go to their website to register. I think it starts in February. That's a great place to go. You go, just there's a lot of different ways that you can skin this cat, but I'm really speaking more to the employer, to give the tools to the employees and show them that you care, show them that you want to show them how to pay off the debts that they have. They need to know how to say no in their family situations. They need to know how to buy a house and how much money they should be spending on a house. All these basic things that honestly, no one teaches you this stuff. So you have to figure it out on your own. All right, we're going to take a quick break, come back, wrap up the big show. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. Literally less than a minute ago in the show. You know, as I was thinking about all these competing objectives for your dollars when it comes to the challenge of saving for retirement, I mean, think about eating out. Wow. Spending money on clothes, leisure activities, golfing, movies, all that kind of stuff. Vacations. I spent a fortune on vacations. Supporting, obviously, your young adult children, never easy. Supporting your grandchildren. Sometimes you have to say no. Think of Nancy Reagan. Just say no. Sometimes that's the best financial plan and advice old Dave can give you. So I know it's hard to do what you know you need to do to get to where you want to be. But at the end of the day, it's about education. It's about guidance. And it's about advice. People need personalized advice, both in person and online. I mean, most people go online first, but in person is also very, very good and powerful. The two methods can be used in combination to allow people to self-serve when appropriate and then to interact with an advisor when necessary. Everyone, thank you so much for hanging out with me. Next week, we're going to be talking taxes some more, continue to motivate you to do what you need to do to get ready for higher taxes to come in the future. Hey, everyone, have a great night. Or a great weekend, and we'll talk to you next week. Goodbye. The preceding program was brought to you by Comprehensive Financial Consultants and CFCI, which is solely responsible for its content. Securities are offered through J.W. Cole Financial, member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI and J.W. Cole Advisors. J.W. Cole Financial, J.W. Cole Advisors, and CFCI are unaffiliated entities.